Good morning. I don't know if you guys encountered it, but some of us encountered the fact that the elevators seem to be moving slower today from the parking garage up to here. That's not an excuse for the last couple of minutes. I just got wordy, and that's the excuse for the last couple of minutes of delay. But having apologized to you in that funky manner, I'm now going to call the regularly scheduled meeting for December to order. And the time on the clock is 9:10 a.m. Welcome. A couple of administrative points, which you regular attendees are probably sick and tired of hearing, but we got to do it. Members of the public who wish to address the Housing Commission must complete a speaker request form. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes each. Collective testimony by those who support or oppose an item shall be limited to no more than 15 minutes total per side. Non-agenda public comments are heard at the beginning of each meeting, and those who wish to address the board about a topic that is not on the agenda must fill out a white speaker request form. Members of the public also may request to have an item pulled from the consent agenda once that's been announced by submitting a speaker request form at that time. To speak on a matter on the agenda, members of the public must complete a speaker request form and submit it to the recording secretary before the item is called. Those who wish to speak in opposition to the item must complete the pink-colored form, and those in favor of the item must complete the gold-colored form. I have no speaker request form, so we'll just keep on moving at that point, or at this point. So, commissioner comments. Commissioners, how are you? We skipped the November meeting and postponed it to now, so we haven't seen each other since October. Okay, any comments? Okay, I have a comment. Oh, you have a comment.
Well, I would like to congratulate you on being the commissioner of the year with
Thank
Negro.
You. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, let me just add on to that, if I could, for a second. I had the pleasure of being able to go to the conference where you were awarded that recognition, and this is a really big deal, and it's a tribute to the work that you have been doing over the number of years here in this industry. And clearly, the attendees, the officials within NARO were, you know, just glowing in their remarks about you, and it reflects on everybody in this organization. And so congratulations for your leadership. It's a big deal what you've accomplished, and it was nice that you were recognized for it. So again, congrats.
Well, thank you. Now there's that old line, I couldn't do it without you, but the truth of the matter is, I'm one component of this organization that we proudly call the San Diego Housing Commission. And, I have a role to play. The board has a role to play. That is different from the role of management and the role of the rest of the staff. But the fact of the matter is that all of those components work together to make what we do really work. And because what we do as a team works, San Diego is recognized at least nationally. And to some degree, there's a little bit of international recognition of the San Diego Housing Commission and what is becoming somewhat known, not just amongst ourselves, but amongst others, as the San Diego model. We're known for trying different things. We're known for having a better attitude in many ways about what can be accomplished and what can be effective. And as I say, we provide leadership, but that's the result of just a really, really good team that is here and shows up and from everything we can see takes pride in what you as staff and on down the ones that are not here, the pride that they take in what they're doing and the mission they're serving and our clientele. So. I get recognized, and that, trust me, that was beautiful. But a large part of that recognition is due to the organization as a whole, and not just to what I do at NARO. So, thank you. I have another comment, and that's I'm going to very narrow it very tightly about the election that we just experienced. Okay. And I'm only going to talk about one particular item because it affects us, and that is ballot measure M. Now, for those of you who just go through and vote, and then the moment you walk out of the election booth, you forget what everything was, I'm going to remind you that ballot measure M was a city measure that was placed on the ballot to authorize an increase and the total number of residential units that this housing commission can help to create, either directly or through partnerships or bond subsidies or whatever. And our old limit was 10,000 units. Well, we were still a long ways away from the maximization of that, but this year seemed like a really good opportunity to come forth and accomplish an increase in that. And so we got that. We presented that to individual council members first, and then the city council approved unanimously, you know, walking across the aisles there, and said, we like the idea. former, since we're now in December, former city councilman Todd Gloria was chosen by the council to write the ballot proposition itself, and the list of people who went on to in favor of the ballot argument, Mayor Faulkner, the president and CEO of the San Diego County Taxpayers Association, Amy Fawcett of the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce, Jean Grown, president of the San Diego League of Women's Voters, all of them supported publicly the proposition, and no one opposed it. How could you oppose it? It didn't cost the city anything. Didn't cost the taxpayers anything. All it's doing is saying, hey, if the demand is there and if we can find the resources, we can increase the number of units that we're involved with from just slightly above 10,000 to 38,680. So we got an opportunity. This fits into the city's general plan, and it fits into SANDAG's regional plan regarding providing affordable homes in San Diego. So we're being proactive in that regard. We only needed 50% plus one for approval of the measure. And what I can tell you is that if Dean Spanos and the Chargers had worked as hard and created as good a plan for the city as we did, their measure would have been approved because we got 66%. Okay. I just wanted to comment on the fact that this has been accomplished, and we have the capacity now to continue trying to find good quality housing for our residents. So, good work. Next is comes the opportunity to present the consent agenda, and I'm proposing at this time that items 100, 101, 102, and 104 be placed on consent.
Mr. Chairman, are you sure you wanted to add 101 to that?
Huh? I forgot. I'll come back to you. Okay. Actually, it's been proposed by another member of our board here,
okay.
Commissioner Spoon, that we add that to it.
Well, she's the author of it, so we're good.
and she has discussed it in great detail with our financial staff. And
right.
Move approval.
Okay.
Second.
Counselor?
Yes, thank you. If you could incorporate on the two items that deal with housing development partners are item 102 and item 104, if the record could reflect the conflict statement that's included within the reports, I would appreciate it.
Commissioner Tassin, would you approve of that?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I appreciate staff including that in there. It's pretty clear, and I think out of an abundance of caution and transparency, that was a good thing to include in there. So reflected.
Okay, Commissioner Spoon, would you second that? All right, it's been moved and seconded. The consent agenda has been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Seeing no indication of such, I'll call the question. All in favor of the consent agenda, please say aye. Opposed? The consent agenda is approved unanimously. Now I'll go back to this guy who just loves to add comments. I skipped him here. I apologize. A report by the President and Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Gentry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got about a half dozen items I just want to bring to the board's attention, the public too for that matter, on either occurrences or honors or recognitions since the last board meeting. And since the last board meeting was several weeks ago, we've got a number of them here. On October the 20th, I'd like to point out that we, the Housing Commission, received federal recognition for our 1,000 Homeless Veterans Initiative, which we kicked off earlier this year. I was honored to join the HUD Secretary, Julian Castro, and Mayor Faulkner, and several business leaders from across the nation on a national conference call about veterans' homelessness. And the conference call shined a spotlight on our Housing Our Heroes program, the landlord outreach program, which Mayor Faulkner has been championing, as well as the full efforts we've been doing to get 1,000 vets housed, additional vets housed, in the year leading up to March the 1st next year. And I'll point out to the board that as of November, some 424 veterans have secured housing in this program, and housing provided by 263 landlords who have made 702 rental units available for this purpose. And I'll point out that in addition to the 424 veterans looking, there are about 250 who've been approved and are out looking for units right now with the help of our housing counselors. So this is program is moving at pace. It's showing some real significance, and we're getting recognition nationally for it. I'll also point out that in October, there were four partnership developments which we participate in, which celebrated grand openings for a total of 343 additional affordable housing rental units available during Housing America Month. It was a huge month for the end result of a number of our programs. And I'd just like to call out these properties to you for your information. One is Trolley Park Terrace, a 51-unit new construction property in the Choyas View neighborhood in the southeastern part of the city, Council District 3. Again, 51. Yes, sir, it is 4. Sorry, it is 4. Council District 4, which we had a number of participants with us there for that grand opening, including Myrtle Cole and the mayor and Commissioner Tassin. Frank was there. He knew what district it was in. Also in October, we participated in the grand opening of the Mayberry Townhomes, which provides 69 newly renovated affordable rental townhomes for low-income working families. We partner with Community Housing Works in that program. I'll point out that in the former program, we partnered with Chelsea and the Chelsea organization, which we've done a lot of work with in the past as well. Mayberry Townhomes with Community Housing Works, and that's 69 units newly renovated. In Marty Emerald's district, Council District 9. Also in October, we participated in the grand opening of the Cielo Carmel development, which is 195 rental units for low-income families in the Pacific Highlands Ranch, north of State Route 56 and Council District 1. And I'll point out that this represents the efforts by this organization to get more affordable housing scattered throughout the city. I was able to join Representative Scott Peters, also Council President Sherry Leitner, and the developer there, the Affirmed Housing Group. Also, the fourth development that we participated in the grand opening of was also in Pacific Highlands Ranch, Torrey Vale. These apartments provided 28 newly affordable units in the northern part of the city as well. This development also done by the Chelsea Investment Corporation, and we were able to join President Leitner, whose district also includes this particular property. So both Cielo, Carmel, and Torrey Vale, again, I'll point out, are in the North City Future Urbanizing Area. And to date, in that area, some 627 affordable units have been constructed, again, in a non-traditional area for affordable housing in this city. And I just wanted to point out the significance of those numbers. That was a good month for us. I'll also point out that at our national NARO conference in October, in addition to our chairman receiving award as the chairman of the year, I'll remind folks again, for the whole nation, the Housing Commission also received two program awards, and these were awards of excellence. And one was for our Housing First San Diego program, which, as you all may remember, kicked off in November of 2014, in which the Housing Commission has got a multi-pronged effort to increase our involvement in providing resources for our homeless folks. We also received an award of excellence for a program in our Achievement Academy called Jumpstart Your Career, which helps our residents and clients try to get on their feet economically and to locate employment and move their lives forward. This particular program connects young people ages 18 to 24 with employment or education opportunities. And in the first 10 months of this program in 2015, 82% of the participants found jobs or enrolled in college classes or vocational training. Pretty good number. Again, showing that we're more about just the physical structures, that we're about people and trying to get help people get their lives improved. Also, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to talk just a couple of minutes about some other things that may well occur next year as a consequence of the election. And I'd like to thank this board for moving the board meeting from 2 weeks ago to today. What moving this board meeting allowed me to do was to attend a conference in Washington, D.C. with an organization called the Council of Large Public Housing Authorities. And I sit on the board of that organization currently. And we were able to receive some information and feedback about likely changes next year with their federal funding. And I will remind the board that although we are a local organization, about 80% or so of our funding comes from Washington, D.C. It comes from the feds, primarily from HUD. And I think two things. Number one, anybody that says they know what's going to happen next year is probably needs to be committed. And I'm not going to tell you I know what's going to happen next year. But just a couple of prospects, one of which is negative and one of which is positive, that we staff has already begun talking about how to position ourselves to deal with. Number one, the negative, is it is likely that we can expect some reduction in funding beginning with our next fiscal year. I think it's just going to happen. If you look at had the continuing resolution that the Congress was going to extend from next week throughout next year taken effect, what I learned is that we would probably have been shaved on our Section 8 funding, which is our biggest funded program, probably would have been shaved by about 2%. There was also talk at the time of another 1% across the board for all non-defense discretionary programs, which includes us. And that would have been the bare minimum reduction for our fiscal year 18 funding, fiscal year 17 funding, which begins next July 1st. With the CR continued until March and the prospect of a budget after that, which I doubt will be any more than what would have been under the CR, we're probably looking at some further reductions from that. the board members may remember the sequestration, which hit in 2013, which shaved our big program by 5%. We saw that coming a year ahead of time. We took corrective measures to reduce voucher issuance and to utilize reserves properly. And from an existential standpoint, the Housing Commission was not harmed. We did wind up with 723 fewer vouchers than we would have had absent sequestration, and that's a detriment to the community. But the organization itself didn't miss a beat, and the other responsibilities we have, we carried off without a hitch. And I expect this to be the same. I just need the board to understand that we probably are looking at on our voucher funding, which is our biggest program, and probably some of the other programs in a collateral way, funding will probably be shaved a bit from what it is now, up to, I figure, 5%. Maybe a touch more, probably not. But that's, again, more of a guess than a statistical prediction. The silver lining going forward is that if you look at the comments that have been made, and there haven't been too many, about affordable housing from a federal standpoint, I think that what we can expect are efforts related to deregulation, local control, operating a public sector organization more like private sector. And in a lot of respects, this organization is already there. What I was charged with 8 years ago was to change the organization so that it would operate, understanding we're always going to be public and have a public sector obligations, responsibilities, and transparencies. That goes without saying. But that we would operate much like a private sector nonprofit insofar as we could and make things make sense here from a business standpoint. And so I'm not too worried longer term about what we are, where we're going, and whatever the vagaries of policy might come out of Washington, D.C. in any respect. So I just wanted the board to understand that. And I'd be glad to respond to any questions right now if anybody has any.
I have, Commissioner Cass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the Housing Our Heroes update, Mr. Gentry. I heard you talk about our goal's 1,000. We've housed 400 and something. Did I hear you say that what's the inventory that we have in terms of what landlords have stepped up for? 700 plus, and so there's 200-300 available units right now.
And we have about that same number of people on the street looking. So it's just that the issue is I have no doubt that by the end of the 1 year time period, we will have identified and provided assistance in looking to the full 1,000. This program, I will remind the board, was a 2-year program where we're going to be aggressive and get everybody under lease within the first year, or at least identified and in process in the first year, and I have no doubt that's going to happen. They may not all be all 1,000 be housed by March the 1st, but they'll be identified. We'll be in process, and it's 2 years' worth of money. But in addition to the 424, there's about, as I recall, Jeff, about 250 that have been issued vouchers that are out looking. And so you look at that, that's pushing 700 right there. I guess my point is we've had wonderful response from the landlord community. And once we're able to get these folks identified, processed, and in place, the resources are there. One of the things that we're not doing is just plopping people into units, that we're making sure that there is a counseling agency that has referred this individual to us, and that the support services are there. And some of that just takes a little time.
You know, I don't want to just gloss over that. That's a big accomplishment to be able to get landlords to step up in this market today, to be able to participate in something like this. That's a big deal.
And I think it reflects, I think, three things, Frank. And one is Mayor Faulkner. And I think him using the bully pulpit of the mayor's office to reach out and to get people to respond was huge. He was able to get the apartment associations, landlord groups. That was huge. But that just opens the door. What closes the door is the wonderful work done by these staff out here. And what, and in two regards, I think that's basically closing the door the mayor opened. And one part of that is a process where we handle the customer from start to finish. These folks don't always have the best skills in negotiating the marketplace. And by having housing navigators, counselors, if you will, to help some of these folks find the place and then to interrelate with the landlord in what is strictly speaking a landlord-tenant relationship, we serve as a broker of sorts, is huge. And that's helping close this. And then the third issue is one of program design. We don't expect people in the private sector to lose money working in our social programs. That's not the way the world works, and we don't expect it to. And so we sweeten the pot with respect to security deposits and landlord guarantees so that the landlord community and working with what is sometimes a problematic customer base, and that's the fact, that they feel comfort they won't lose money doing it. So I think the fact that the mayor's opened the doors with these folks and that we're making it a customer-friendly experience to the landlords is making it work, and it's going to be a good success.
Yeah, and another point on the number of people who are going through the process is there is a verification process that slows some of that down because we have to make sure that the people who are applying for it are actually entitled to veterans benefits. So the VA is involved in a little bit of the vetting as well.
There is process there. Comments or questions about the Washington, D.C. stuff, understanding that it's all speculation, but I'm comfortable that, particularly compared with the industry, which some of you have gotten pretty familiar with, this organization is well-positioned, I think, to deal with any set of policy changes that come out of Washington, D.C.
And one of the things that, when we talk about the effects of the last sequestration and the fact that we in effect lost 723 plus or minus vouchers, is because of the pre-planning that this organization did, no one actually lost their voucher. What happens is in the course of any given month, there are people who come out of the program, either because they relocated or because their personal circumstances have improved to the point that luckily, they no longer qualify for the Section 8 because they've improved themselves. So those 723 became available to take out of the program as vacancies occurred in that program. So we didn't just kick somebody out on the street from there. It's just that we couldn't process new recipients of the vouchers to that amount on it. So, there was a little bit of heart that was accomplished there because of pre-planning. So the pre-planning that you're doing now.
And there were other organizations that literally took vouchers away from families already issued because they couldn't honor it and or went into landlords and summarily shaved rental payments to the landlords, which is not a good way to build friendly by a batch of landlords. So I think the fact that we saw it coming, we took measures about half and half. We reduced the issuance of vouchers and then utilized reserves both as a cushion so that I think we managed it quite well. And we will for coming problems as well. I'll point out that there is one complication that has happened over the last year. There was nothing we could do about this. The reserves and for our program, for our Section 8 programs, which we used to hold, HUD now holds for us. And all with all the implications therein.
Thanks for that great news.
If I could, I've got one other item. Okay. If there are no further questions. And I'm going to ask Maria to... we're going to do a little bit of a dog and pony show for you. Also, at the end of October, we published our most recent multimedia annual report. It's electronic. I hope you've seen it. And we want to do just a couple of minutes here showing off. Maria, all yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gentry, Chairman Grambling, and Commissioners, and Mr. Christensen. This is the fifth annual multimedia digital report we have produced. And so what's new this year? We have added quick, compelling facts that tell our story for those readers who just want to first focus on the headlines. For example, taking a look on page 6, here's a snapshot of how many actions this Board of Commissioners took in the fiscal year 2016, 179. And all of these actions are captured in the report appendix, which lists all the board reports which with hyperlinks to our website. In addition, having a multimedia digital report allows us to embed videos and graphics, including those stories that we don't videotape ourselves, such as the Congressional Subcommittee testimonies of our CEO, Rick Gentry, in Washington, D.C., which you'll find on page 10. Emmanuel's trying to keep up with me right here. Thank you, Emmanuel. And because this annual report is published on our website, we're able to add updates after the publication date, which was October 30th of this year. Here's a good example on page 17, Ballot Measure M, as you heard from Chairman Grambling. It is a big success for residents in the city of San Diego and for the San Diego Housing Commission. We added the voter tally right after the day of after the election on November 9th. Also, throughout our annual report, we feature profiles of individuals who have benefited from our programs. Page 30. A proud graduate of our San Diego Housing Achievement Academy is Heidi. She's a Housing Choice Rental Assistance Voucher recipient who graduated this June from UCSD with a doctorate degree in sociology. And Heidi's past includes being a pregnant teen and being homeless and then finding some help with the San Diego Housing Commission and, of course, the Achievement Academy. And one last fact to share with you on page 34 really drives our mission home when you see it in print. 76% of our rental assistance households earn an average income of $12,798. More than half of these individuals are families. 47% are seniors or disabled individuals. Our report contains four distinct sections, which includes our rental assistance programs, our achievements in creating and preserving affordable housing, and our efforts in addressing homelessness. This is a 139-page report and serves as an important tool for us when it comes to educating our diverse publics about the work that we do here at the San Diego Housing Commission. Many thanks to our departments and their teams for working with us throughout the year, helping to tell our story. And I really mean that, Debbie and Jeff and all the vice presidents here, all your teams. It was terrific working with you. In addition, I want my communications team to stand up. Scott Marshall and Emmanuel Velasco, who were the leads in drafting the report and the layouts. The team also includes Garford Alexander, Jose Lopez, Penny Martin, and Debbie Levinson-Cruz, who were contributors, writers, photographers, editors, and happy critics, and we needed those. So thank you very much.
Could you go back to that last slide? Yes. I just wanted to point out something here. $12,798 annual income for 76% of our recipients. San Diego area median income, $73,500. That's the gap that exists here that we're trying to alleviate some of the impacts of. So I think those are two very significant numbers. Well, I'm going to make one additional comment, and that is about the Achievement Academy. Most of the housing agencies in the country are treating the housing need as a two-legged stool, and that is, basically find shelter and, if possible, get some counseling. But alleviating homelessness is a three-legged stool. We've got to get them sheltered. That's the housing first concept. We've got to get good mental health counseling and other counseling to try to deal with the non-monetary issues that cause the homelessness in the first place. And then the Achievement Academy addresses the third leg of the stool, and that is, how can we help our clients, our customers, our clients, I like to call them clients, how can we help them get the skills that they can advance themselves to the point that they get off the program because they can find good, meaningful employment? And the example of Heidi, who went from, a single parent, homeless, single teenage parent, to homeless, to Section 8, to a doctoral graduate from UCSD, just goes to the, now that's the extreme, but if we can just work with the idea of, through the Achievement Academy, begin to satisfy that third leg, we're going to have even greater successes in the future on that. And Mr. Gentry, he hasn't said this, but Mr. Gentry has been told by this board that that's going to continue to be a very significant part of the expectations that we have of him and of this organization. Moving right along, you've all received the minutes of our October 7th meeting. You've had an opportunity to review them. Are there any corrections, deletions? I guess a deletion is a correction. Any suggested corrections? Seeing no indication of such, does anyone care to recommend that we approve those minutes? Commissioner Tassin has moved approval. Commissioner Davis, I started to call her Maggie. Commissioner Davis has seconded that. Any discussion now? Seeing no indication of such, I'll call the question. And approval of the minutes, please indicate by saying aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. Now we'll go all the way down to item 103.
Good morning, Commissioners, Chair Gramling, Mr. Gentry, Mr. Christensen. I'm Debbie Ruane. I'm going to turn this presentation over almost immediately to Wendy DeWitt at my right. I wanted to point out that this is a very important request of you to approve this fund for the market assessment approval, and we are very pleased to have in the audience our consultants, who Wendy will introduce, as well as our partner at Civic San Diego, Michael Lengel, who's a senior project manager, and Susan Baldwin from SANDAG, a senior regional planner. Wendy?
Thank you, Debbie, and good morning. Item 103 is concerning a project that we have in partnership with Civic San Diego to design, implement, and manage a San Diego Affordable Housing TOD Transit-Oriented Development Fund. As Debbie mentioned, our consultants here, Forsyth Street Advisors, are present. Mr. Tyler Van Gundy on your left and Ulysse Leibens on the right here, with Michael Lengel of Civic in the middle. So we're pleased to have them here today. The action that we're requesting of you is that the Housing Commission recommend Housing Authority of the City of San Diego to approve the San Diego Affordable Housing Transit-Oriented Development Fund market assessment and authorize Forsyth Street Advisors to proceed with fund implementation. Approval of the market assessment and authorization to proceed with fund implementation will direct the San Diego TOD fund investment to identified market opportunity areas in conformance with Housing Commission and City of San Diego policy objectives. It will confirm the financial products that the San Diego TOD fund will initially prioritize for offering, approve general parameters for a loan fund, authorize proceeding with a capital structure that utilizes public investment funds as credit enhancement for senior debt, and create a governance structure that allows the public sponsors to be highly engaged, governed by a credit committee of key stakeholders. As a little background, the project began in January of 2016 when the Housing Commission and Civic San Diego jointly entered into a contract with Forsyth Street Advisors to create, implement, and manage a San Diego TOD fund. The objectives of the fund are to leverage the Housing Commission and Civic's affordable housing financing resources, spur mixed-use, mixed-income affordable housing development near transit, and support the City of San Diego's smart growth and climate action plan policy objectives. The fund is proposed to be capitalized with a mix of public, private, and philanthropic funds and provide below-market interest rate loans for the creation and preservation of affordable housing near transit. The goal is to raise between $60 million and $100 million of investment by leveraging a minimum of $3 of private capital for every $1 of public funds. Forsyth Street Advisors is a specialty finance and municipal advisory firm based in New York City with over 10 years of experience in deployment and management of public-private investment funds. They have designed, implemented, and currently serve as fund manager for the New York City Acquisition Fund, as well as the New Generation Fund in the city of Los Angeles. A sub-consultant to Forsyth is Seifel Consulting, based in San Francisco. Seifel is an urban economics advisory firm with experience in guiding the creation of transit-oriented developments and more than 100 redevelopment projects. The San Diego TOD Fund project has three phases. Phase one, what we're bringing here to you today, is the fund design. It consists of conducting a very thorough market assessment, and from the results of that market assessment come the fund concept recommendations. Phase two is the actual fund implementation. So if we receive approval today from this board as well as the city council, where we'll go after the first of the year, then the implementation will begin. The fund would be structured, the governance created, investor outreach and commitments, and then an actual closing of the fund would occur. Phase three of the project is the fund management, which includes the day-to-day administration of fund operations, which would be performed by Forsyth Street Advisors under the contract. So phase one is now complete, and at this point in the presentation, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Tyler Van Gundy to discuss the results of the market assessment and what the fund concept recommendations consist of. Tyler?
Great. Thank you, Wendy. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you all for having me here. I just wanted to actually first give a little quick summary as I've been listening to the conversation so far. This program is fundamentally a public-private investment fund. The job is to look for financing gaps in the market where we can create a vehicle that is outside of the commission by technical legal control, but still coordinated from a policy and investment standpoint such that we can provide a beneficial financing resource in the market to incent and assist in the creation of more affordable housing. This is not the creation of a new subsidy resource, but rather it is the creation of a capital product that is beneficial, whether from a term and or a pricing perspective, that provides more certainty to the market, to the developers, so that they have a greater understanding of the suite of tools that are available to them from the commission resources all the way down to the private financing options that are necessary that they all take advantage of to bring their projects forward. So to that point, as Wendy laid out, there's three phases that we laid out in our initial contract. The first piece is to execute a market assessment, which is to understand simply what are those financing opportunities, what are those financing gaps in the market. And what's very interesting about this project is that it's not only what are the gaps in the market, but it was a specific policy agenda, which is what are the gaps and how can they relate and overlap to the creation of transit-oriented housing. So a very specific subset of what the commission is interested in. The second piece, of course, is the implementation and capitalization, which we, with your approval, hope to begin in 2017. And, of course, the third part is the ongoing management of the fund. So I'd like to go through a couple different pieces of our market analysis. The first is what are the development opportunities? The second is the result of our outreach to the community. The third is talk a little bit about the product opportunities that we uncovered, the needs in the market. And the last piece, of course, is what is our structural approach and what is the proposed organizational structure of the fund. So the first piece in the market analysis is to do a very deep dive scan of what are development opportunities across the entire city. And our approach really came down to looking at four fundamental qualities, which is how do we define smart growth? What does that mean in San Diego? The first piece is to look at the existing and planned transit nodes. So where does the transit system serve what neighborhoods today? Where is the transit system expected to open new transit nodes, new transit lines that are going to serve certain neighborhoods? Second piece of this is what is the transit accessibility as measured by the median number of transit stations or boardings within that area. So to understand basically what's the frequency or use of those transit nodes in a specific geography. The third is what's the growth potential? What does the market look like? There are obviously very built out neighborhoods that have existing transit. There are also transit lines that are being put in place where there's the opportunity for a significant amount of growth over time. And then the fourth is, of course, defining transit. We looked specifically at light rail and or rapid bus service as the definition for what we look at in terms of what is transit accessibility. So we came up with a very detailed analysis in our full report, and this is just one simple map of how we looked at what the opportunities are. And I'd like to just point out a couple of things. The first is you'll notice that every circle that we have here on this map is fundamentally an opportunity from a transit-oriented smart growth policy perspective, meaning we see from multiple different characteristics the opportunity to incent and work with the development community for the creation of affordable and mixed-income housing across the city in many different neighborhoods. There's a lot of diversity. There's lots of diversity of opportunities. There's also a lot of diversity of need. And if you take a look quickly on the top left, you can see that not only did we slice everything by the type of neighborhood, whether it's an urban center, a community center, a rural village, et cetera, we also separated each of those targeted locations by the existing transit versus the potential going forward. So we're looking at this both from a short-term perspective and a long-term perspective across all of the different geographies. And in our report, we have a much deeper analysis looking at each one of these areas. We've done a fair amount of detailed statistical analysis as to what each of those neighborhoods look like from a median income quality, the development opportunities, the status of existing planning, and what each targeted location looks like from basically from an affordable housing development opportunity looking forward. Sure, absolutely. So we have, in order to go down this analysis, we have spent a fair amount of time, a lot of time, with our sub-consultant, Libby Seifel, working with Civic, working with the Housing Commission, working with SANDAG as well, working through their existing data sets to define what we think of as opportunities. This has also been done in conjunction with our outreach process, which is not only do we want to look at the data, but we also spent a lot of time working with the development community. Some of this is a statistical process. The other part of this is art, which is what does the development community see and what do they think the opportunities are today and going forward as they are looking at their planned programs and what their pipelines look at. So we've spent a significant amount of time working through this question of defining opportunity, both from a statistical perspective as well as what the community is interested in and what the development community has seen or is seeing. So the output of this from a policy and financing gap perspective is a very, in a certain sense, a very simple outcome, but is a very specific outcome. In order to create an incentive program that is going to drive more affordable in transit areas, there's the need for both a short and a midterm, potentially longer term acquisition product. That simply means short being defined generally as 2 to 3 years, medium and long being defined as anywhere from 3 to 7 years. And that is the need from the development community to be able to acquire sites so that they can hold on to those sites, work them through their pre-development process, and bring them into the subsidy pipelines managed by the Housing Commission or the state resources and the other various resources that are needed to develop housing. So what is very different about this, and I find very interesting in San Diego, is the short term is a very understood but always a very – that's a very risky product, financing product from a lender's perspective. But it's the medium and long-term option that is very different. And the development community is very interested and very open to taking that holding risk, that term holding risk, to acquire certain sites so that they are locked into the pipeline over time, so that we have a good sense as to what the 5-year development plan could be from the development community. And that is a very big that's a very big change in the financing markets for affordable. It's very hard to raise any capital that is going to take any sort of risk beyond the known expected subsidy allocation process that the Housing Commission or other agencies are willing to commit to. So there's this great opportunity between what the options are in the market, the long-term development strategies of the transit lines, and the development community's interest to get ahead of that curve. And this is all about getting ahead of that curve so that we can take advantage of some of the value opportunities today to be able to have sites under control that can be developed into affordable and mixed-income housing in the future. This slide provides a very simple outline of the proposed products. As you can see, the short and midterm acquisition financing, these really are simply bridge loans for acquisition as well as pre-development costs to get to subsidy, to get to a construction project. The longer-term acquisition is a bridge, but ultimately a holding program so that sites can be held onto by the development community for the future allocation of subsidies. I'd like to just talk quickly about the structural approach. As I mentioned before, this is intended to be a new long-term resource. This is intended to be a permanent program for the Housing Commission. This is not a one-time investment program, but rather this is an ongoing. We're originally structuring this as a 10-year program. It's an ongoing program that's going to be available to the development community that is sponsored by the Housing Commission. It is going to be set up specifically to work with your policy objectives, structured based on the policy objectives today, but has the ability to modify those over time as the Housing Commission changes its strategies or tweaks some of its strategies over time. Everything is going to be coordinated with your subsidy resources. So to the prior discussion, the fund is investing against the existing subsidy pots. If those are going to change over time or we have a projection that they may be increasing or decreasing, it is the fund's job to make sure that we are in balance with the existing resources that the commission has. It is not in anyone's interest to have the fund or the Housing Commission out of balance with what the actual output can potentially be. The sponsor contributions will be ultimately leveraged capital. We have achieved in multiple programs that we have put out into the market anywhere from 4 to 6 times private leverage. Basically what this means is the the commitment of sponsor resources, while it is important from an actual dollar perspective, it's the representation of what that capital means to the private community. They look at each dollar that the sponsors put in as a commitment from a policy perspective for the future resources, subsidy resources, meaning we can get very efficient leverage just by having the representation of sponsor capital contributions into the fund. And the most important part of this program ultimately is a governance mechanism. These are discretionary, non-legal controlled investment funds, so it is not under the Housing Commission's legal control. But we set up the governance system such that nothing can be done without an affirmative action by the designated representative from the Housing Commission. We do not make investments without ensuring that everything is in balance, whether that is the developer that is selected is in good standing, whether it is a project that meets your policy objectives, ensuring that it is a financially viable project, but most importantly, that everything is balanced from a future budgeting and planning perspective with the Commission's forward projections. That's what makes these programs tick, and that's what allows us to provide a beneficial product in the market. That is the most important aspect of this. And working through the precise legal mechanisms where we can have that credit body, that governance body, and who that representative is, that's going to be part of 2017's job to figure out the precise details of how we put together that investment body. This last slide is a is a quick outline. This is not a legal outline, but rather a conceptual chart for how this fund is going to be put together. On the left-hand side, we have three different capital sources. On the going bottom up, the subordinate capital is the sponsor contributions. This is the core leverage capital that makes the fund structure tick. There is a great opportunity to engage the foundation and the philanthropic community. It's a great time to engage with the foundations to propose an investment where they are ultimately investing next to city policy, next to city contributions, but ultimately they have the ability to invest in a private fund, a private institution, which is, of course, one of the major requirements of the foundation community. Together, we can use these two resources to obtain, as I said before, a significant amount of leverage from the senior debt community. Ultimately, we're talking to all of the same known institutions, the CRA-driven institutions, and it's going to be our job to bring them to the table in 2017. On the far right-hand side, we have an outline of the quick financing products that we're plan to bring out into the market. And then up on the top, we have a proposed credit committee, which is quite simply going to include representatives from the Housing Commission as well as Civic, of course, representing their investments in the fund. So that is the quick outline of what is provided in our market assessment. And again, appreciate your time and with your approval. Our job is to get into the market in 2017 with term sheets as well as capitalization requests and propose detailed structures that we can work through with both the Housing Commission and Civic and ultimately bring this program to fruition.
Just a couple of finishing points. Thank you, Tyler. To give you an idea of what's next and the timeline for the fund, in January, February of next year, we will take this item forward to the City Council acting as the Housing Authority as well as the city successor entity for the Civic approval. And then begin the implementation, if approved, so that in about November of 2017, we would conduct a fund closing. And then for the next 10 years, from proposed 2017 through 2027, deploy these funds. And that concludes the presentation, and we'll open it up for questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Tessa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Van Gundy, in you're doing your due diligence in this scope of work that you've been you've embarked upon. What when you did your assessment countywide out there of the potential inventory, what proximity to transit are you looking at?
That's a great question. Generally, that is defined as about a half a mile within that transit node. Of course, there are nuances to that definition in all geographies. One important part about that specific question is we don't want to put the funds activities are not going to be governed by that strict black and white rule of a half mile. If there is a particular site that is close to that definition and is of strategic value, of course that is to the benefit of public policy to ensure that that is developed from a mixed income or affordable character. But the general approach, yes, is to look at generally about a half mile context within those transit zones.
And it sounds like you're allowed to use certain discretion there.
Yes.
In doing your assessment of the and thank you for pointing out your description of what kind of transit you're talking about. Did you take into consideration not only the current transit assets, but also planned assets?
Yes, and we did a very interesting analysis about the planned transit lines and the planned transit nodes. One of the questions was, what's happening in the market based on those current planned nodes? Are prices increasing? Are the prices diverging from current value? And how does that impact feasibility? What does that then mean for the development of units over time? One of the interesting, and we actually used the commission's broker go do some analysis for us to go look at current sites that have either traded or are currently on the market in certain planned districts. The simple outcome of that is there is not a lot of appreciation occurring around the planned transit assets, which is good for us, actually.
Yeah.
That is part of why we were looking at this long-term option, this five-year hold option, which is, if that is true and that stays true and there are actual affordable developers that can get into contract on certain sites, ultimately values will rise some amount as nodes come online, whether that is 5%, 10%, or 20% or more over time. We don't know. We're not going to know. But if we can actually hold them today at a low enough carrying cost, that is value that has been captured forward for the future development of housing, simply enough.
Yeah, thank you. That makes sense. Did you take into consideration the value of these assets are tied to the zoning of the property?
Correct.
What you can do on that property. Mm-hmm. Did you take that into consideration, or did you just assume that, you know, you might be able to change that?
The answer is both. certain assets can be developed as of right today. We looked at what their as of right potential is. We also looked in certain neighborhoods where there is a current planning process for potential rezonings, either in the short term, whether 2 years, 3 years, or four years forward. So we did meet with the planning department to discuss what they're seeing over the short term and how that may impact our plans. That's a little harder to... that's more of the art side than the science side, because we don't necessarily know precisely
right.
How densities will change any time in the future specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But we did spend a fair amount of time understanding where some of those community plans, where they're changing and what the timeline is to roll out some of those community plans. And that's going to be part of our ongoing targeting from a policy and marketing perspective.
Thank you. One more, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for describing the sources of the of what this fund would where they would derive the funds. Did you come up with any kind of projections? I mean, I know it's difficult to do, but I mean, when you're looking at foundations or philanthropists or even the CRA institutions, any idea that you can provide this board on
sure.
at least in a range?
I'll go from the middle out. Foundation community is almost impossible to predict. That's just a question of whether we have an interested local institution who we can get in front of and make a good pitch. I've generally found that there is a window of opportunity when these programs are rolling out. It's new, and you also have a new opportunity for that community, whoever that targeted institution is. They also like to invest along governmental policy, and this is an independent program. So as long as we are presenting housing policy as a private institution, and it's new, oftentimes we can get a lot of interest from them. Precisely what that amount is, I really do not know, but anywhere in the $1 to $3 to $4 million is entirely possible as a charitable investment, meaning a program-related investment, which is what we would be requesting from the philanthropic community.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I thought if I could just cut one more here. I took note in the staff report that this fund already exists, I believe, in Los Angeles and in San Francisco and New York, actually, right?
Yes. Every fund is different. The the structure and the objective of a public-private fund incented or set up by a housing department, yes, those exist. But every one of these programs is drastically different. And they're different because every market and every city is very different. The Housing Commission's management of its business here is very different than the Mayor's Office of Housing in San Francisco, is very different from Housing Preservation and Development in New York, and very different from Housing and Community Investment in Los Angeles. So the concept exists, but the precise details of the structure and the governance and the oversight is very different, and that is very specific to San Diego. And in fact, the transit overlay, which is very new here, and the opportunities that San Diego actually, or the market allows for, that doesn't exist anywhere else. I can go on for...
No, I get it. It makes sense what you just, what you responded. Give me a feel, though, for a magnitude of what the impact of this potential fund could be. I understand this is a very different market from the others that you've been working in. But what's the, how much of value are we going to be providing? Give us an idea.
I think of value in a couple of different ways. The first is beneficial financing. Ultimately, we're going to be saving money one way or another. Whether that is cheap holding costs or it's high leverage to the development community, a reduction in equity requirements by your developers, there's a detailed analysis that we'll be able to do once we get our core product available and ready to go test in the market. We'll be able to put a number on that. The second thing is site control, which is harder to put a value on. But ensuring that there are enough sites or that sites are under control that define your pipeline looking further into the future, there's a planning value to the Housing Commission of knowing what is coming down the pike. You eliminate some uncertainty. That's hard to put a number on, but it gives you also that lens and understanding what's going to happen to maybe even 5 years forward, because you might actually have certain of those strategic sites that you can then plan for starting today for what actually might get into construction in 5 years. That's a huge operational value that is hard to put a number on. And the third piece is, we don't know exactly how big this is going to be. It depends on leverage and demand and how everything is planned out, but ultimately this is going to be something in the $60 to $70 million range. That's the type of capital commitments we are thinking of. It could be larger. That's probably what we're thinking about to start. And that's a fair amount of dedicated available capital to the development community that gives them certainty of their business. And that's the other part of this, which is developers play a game of understanding what they can do and what risk they're willing to take today. So giving them a certain level of certainty that if they ultimately find a site that is the right site from the Housing Commission's perspective and is also a site that we can finance, they know that they then have further defined their development pipeline for the next 2, 3, or 4 years. And that's also hard to put a value on, but that gives some stability to certain organizations that is very valuable.
Commissioner Spoon?
Thank you. Excuse me. As to the financing, can you guarantee it will be all new money, especially from the sponsor standpoint? Is the financing from the sponsor standpoint going to deplete existing funds, or will it be new money?
From the sponsor's perspective, that's going to be from future budgeted capital. So whether you consider that new or old,
Tyler,
you have to defer to each organization.
If I may, so the Housing Commission will be putting in $10 million. Civic San Diego will be putting in $10 million. And the additional funds will come from the fundraising that Forsyth does.
And what is the source of the $10 million from the Housing Commission?
We're probably inclusionary funds. Money that we would already be putting towards affordable housing, but we'll use it as seed money to attract other funds.
And that money will then be transferred to a separate 501c3?
Whether it's a 501c3 or an LLC that is a subsidiary of, we're going to work through the precise legal structure, but yes, it will be transferred to an independent entity. That is correct. Of which you will have a governance seat or control on.
Is that even possible, Chuck?
It has been my concern from the outset is to make sure that we don't get into a 1090 issue or 87103 issue. So the devil's in the details. I was just talking to Mr. Gentry. I'm trying to get a meeting set up with LA to see how they did it. And as you know, with HDP, we've taken specific methods of putting that whole entity into new entities that avoids the conflict. I think it can be done, but we need the devils in the details.
As always, ma'am. I think if we did not think there was not a possibility here, we wouldn't be wasting your time with it, frankly. So we think yes. The answer is yes, we think it's possible. But I think we're plowing new ground here. This is something that's been done elsewhere, but as the speaker just said, differently in different places, which is as it should be. So, but that kind of fits in with what we are. We think there's a possibility here. We think that using our money to leverage additional money is a smart thing to do. I think it plugs into the new ethos, if I could coin it that, which I think is going to get even better traction in the future, and that is public-private partnerships, where we use private market discipline to govern the use of public sector monies to expand in our horizons of what we do. So the shorthand, yes, ma'am, I think so. Can I tell you right now exactly what form that's going to be? No, that's why we got a good lawyer on board. Do I think that we'll be able to work it out and Chuck will keep us from getting in trouble? Absolutely.
And in that regard, there are safe harbors under 1090 for 501c3s. So my thinking is that might be where we want to go, but we need to look at it.
And then you're talking about financing a pipeline, a long-term pipeline, which is obviously very costly. When there's no return for, an expected 5, 7, or 10 years, where will that financing come from?
Two things. Ultimately, yes, holding costs can be costly over time. I'll just give you some context for some of our products and our other cities. We have figured out how to ensure that the end cost has been as low as 3.5% with private capital for very highly levered, meaning we're making 90 to 100% LTV loans. So, yes, the number is real, but if you think about that total cost given the more conventional means of what it would cost to hold land, we actually, in a certain sense, are likely to be saving money, if not directly on par, but being able to go out longer while still providing that certainty. We're able to do that because of the sponsor commitment. It comes back to the sponsor's capital. It's both how those dollars are used, but also what those dollars evidence, so we can use that as our bully pulpit when we negotiate with the CRI institution so they understand that the risk of this program is very limited.
Thank you very much. I mean, I love the concept. I have a recollection of hearing this maybe 10 years ago also. Have you talked to Reese about it? Of course you have. of course you have.
Yes. These ideas, in a certain sense, they've been around for years. There's not a lot that's incredibly new about it, but what is the nuance of how you set up the governance and how you operate them, that is what is new. That is what defines success. We spend a lot of time in every municipality, every jurisdiction where we run these programs because it's all about what the local context is, and that defines the operations, and that ultimately defines the success. There have been programs like this that have been put out years prior that did not work because they were expected to be automatic. These things are not automatic. They require a lot of management and control and ultimately handholding to ensure that they get done the way they're expected to.
In my opinion, one of the true advantages of creating this type of a program is that it helps to level out the verities of dealing with the government, because we don't have any idea today, as you heard Mr. Gentry at the beginning of the meeting, we have no idea what the new administration is going to create in terms of housing policy. And 4 years from now, that may change again. We don't know. And so rather than being totally at the mercy of governmental funding sources, creating a vehicle such as this gives us the ability to step out and be able to as you said, plan long, more long range, because of the fact that we've got these these funds and that we can keep going out. I heard you talk about the local foundations, but there are some national foundations out there that we could create a product for them that could speed up that the attainment of that $60 million.
Absolutely. I think all foundations are as complicated a process. I think that with the right story, we can definitely attract some of the nationals. It's also an identification process. There's also an argument that having even one local institution will help bring those nationals to the table. There's a longer conversation there, which we're ready to dive into to see if we can figure out how to bring them to the table, because the benefits from that community are huge if you can bring them to the table.
I have one other, I have one question, and that is, this is December 1st, I believe. 2nd. I lost the day. This is December 2nd. We're going to, I think I know what the outcome of the vote is going to be. And so the question I've got to you is, why aren't we getting to the council before February? They have a couple of meetings in January, because I like to speed things up.
We will try to do that. It's the calendar, you know, and their docketing. It gets very bunched up at the end of the year. So, but we'll do our best.
Mr. Gentry?
At the risk of continuing to beat this horse, I do want to draw the board's attention to one issue we need to be ready to defend. You know, the typical government approach to dealing with money is you spend what you got today and hold out your hand for more tomorrow and then to blame somebody else if you don't have it. And that's not a good way to have long-term planning or management occur. On the other hand, if we take $10 million that could be invested, as Commissioner Spoon was implying, in a discrete project now, or maybe two, and we put that aside for longer-term seed purposes, we're going to get criticized for that. We've already got a reporter snooping around wanting to know why we don't spend all of our money on the poor. So we need to make sure that as a public policy approach here, that we understand that the money's being put to good use, it has prospects for the future. To use an overused word, it's an entrepreneurial way of dealing with government, and we need to make sure that we can defend that when the critics come out. The second thing, and this is, I think, hugely positive, and I'd ask that my compliments go back to Reese and the governance at the Civic Board. The fact that the Commission and Civic are working together on this as equals is huge. And I think it shows the kind of good relationships that have been developed over time. And I think it reflects good things going forward between the two respective city-related organizations.
Any additional comments, questions? Commissioner Tassin?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm ready to move approval.
Okay, it's been moved approval by Commissioner Tassin. It's been seconded by Commissioner Spoon.
The devil's in the details, right? I mean,
the devil's in the details, and we're going to have a chance to review and approve details again as they're going forward.
But the concept is a great one.
I think the concept is absolutely exciting about what doors it opens for the long-term future and growth of this organization, and more importantly, of the product that is delivered. So, okay, I'll call the question. All in favor of the resolution as proposed, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's been approved unanimously. Thank you, staff. Thank you, advisors, and we're looking forward to the future. Thank you. Counselor, are you here to speak on item 105? Please proceed. We may get up and move about just to stretch our legs after that this lengthy meeting so far, but
yeah,
we're not being rude.
No, it won't hurt my feelings at all. I am very, very, very pleased to be here to describe what occurred within the last month or so at the Housing Authority and at the City Council. The staff and the agency have been working since 2014 to try to get this project approved. We worked with the city attorney. We've worked with the council offices. There's been a total involvement of everybody at the Housing Commission. And what we're talking about is a change to the San Diego Municipal Code dealing with the Housing Commission and what the Housing Commission can do without the need to have a Housing Authority approval as well. And maybe as some brief background, I've been general counsel of the Housing Commission since July 1st, 1991, and through that period of time, I've seen a number of different CEOs and executive directors come. There have been seven during that period of time. We started with the mayor sitting at different chairs as well. We started with the mayor sitting, Mayor O'Connor, sitting as the chair of this entity. At that time, there were also two city council members that sat on this board. They didn't really trust the Housing Commission to do anything without having direct control. And so, Susan Golding was the next chair. She decided she really didn't want to be the chair, and so they turned it over to a completely civilian board. Neil Arthur was the next chair. He served for 8 years. Sal Salas came in, and then we have Gary Gramling, who's served for the last 8 years. And so we've gone through a number of 07, all right, through a number of iterations. We've also had, there was a period of time in 1991 where right at the outset, Evan Becker was the executive director, and he left soon in 1991. And at that time, because of concern by the mayor about how the agency was running, they put a deputy city manager in as the acting executive director, a guy by the name of Severo Esquivel. And then after that, there were a number of others that came in. After Severo went out, they named Elizabeth Morris as an interim, and after that, she became the permanent CEO. At some point thereafter, I think in 2007, she resigned, and there's a temporary appointment of Carol Vaughn. And then in 2008, Mr. Gentry came on board. The amount of change that I've seen over that period from 1991 to the current is amazing. In 1994, the city council was so concerned about what the Housing Commission was doing, they amended the code to take powers away from them. So it was there was a real era of distrust. And the exciting part of this to me is starting in about 2008, coincidentally, maybe not, with the time that Rick came on board, and this board decided to go forward with the transformation and conversion of the public housing units, there was a period of time where confidence in this agency and this board continued to grow, and there was trust, and there was transparency. And as matters came forward to the Housing Authority, questions were answered. I can tell you in 1991, there were times where questions would be asked at the Housing Authority and there were no answers. That's not a good situation. That whole dynamic has changed, and it's been amazing for me to see it. The other thing is the executive team that Rick's put together is absolutely amazing. Jeff, Debbie, Maria, and all the other executives here can step in and do the work that needs to be done, and they're trusted over at the city council and the mayor. Maybe one of the best examples of this is we brought this matter concerning the code amendment to Smart Growth, and we made the presentation about what the changes were going to be, and Todd Gloria was in support, and Lori Zaff was in support, but council member Sherman had some questions. And so there was a vote to send the matter without recommendation to the full council, and Councilmember Sherman said, I'd like to know more about it. Will you meet with us? And so Debbie said, absolutely. We'll set up the time and we'll come in. So she and I went over and talked to Councilmember Sherman with his chief aide. And we went through the process, explained it completely. They said, Councilmember Sherman said, I like it, but I want to make sure that we know what's being approved at the Housing Commission level. And in some instances, we want to see a pre-approval notice. And we sat back and said, that sounds like a good idea. And so we then worked out working collaboratively with that office, we worked out a process where some pre-notices go out. I'll go through that in a minute. The end result was when the matter finally came forward for an approval at the City Council, Councilmember Sherman made the motion. So proof of the pudding is we're now in a dynamic where this agency is highly respected because of you, because of Rick, and because of the change that's occurred that I've seen. I mean, it's amazing. It's just a total change. In any event, let me get to the exciting part about this. So if we start up here, and this is on November the 15th, the City Council adopted amendments to the San Diego Municipal Code unanimously by a vote of 6-0, and the amendments gave additional authority to this board, and we'll go through those, and also to the president and the CEO. And this Housing Commission board approved the things that we brought forward to the City Council unanimously as well back in May. So there are some things that will not change under the new ordinance. The things that will not change is the annual budget approvals. They wanted to continue to have control of the ultimate budget. That makes sense. Any bond issuance related matters, the TEFRA hearing, or a bond inducement will still have a hearing here and also go to the City Council and or Housing Authority. Memorandum of Understanding concerning labor, the Commission will continue to be advisory on, but we'll have a large part of that as well as we always have. Adoption of any new or amendment of any major policy will continue to be acted on here and then go to the Housing Authority for approval. And then there's a catch-all if at any point in time either the Housing Authority or the City Council wants to take a matter and say that we'd like to hear those as well, they can do that by resolution. I suspect that won't happen, but it's they wanted that ability, and so it's in there. And it's by resolution rather than an ordinance, so it can be done very quickly. So what's new? The following, the matters set forth in this list that I'm going to go through, including the acquisition of real estate or the sale of real estate or the lease of real estate of more than 5 years or the expenditure of more than $1 million on any development, rehabilitation loan, or contracts for the acquisition of goods or services will require that a notice 7 days in advance of the Housing Commission's meeting be given to each Housing Authority member. This is, I'll call this the Sherman Amendment. He wanted to know before the matter came forward, wanted us to highlight for them things that they felt were major. And we thought that was a reasonable request, and that's built into the ordinance now. By the way, Maria and her team and Debbie and her team got together and jointly have procedures now that will allow this to happen, and we've worked it all out. She's done an amazing job. Debbie's team had some comments on practicalities, and we've worked that all out. We had an internal presentation yesterday to staff to explain that. This process will kick off for the meeting on the 13th of January. So this new ordinance will become effective December 15th. So it's here. And it's exciting. This is going to save time and money and reduce as part of your demand to the Housing Commission that they do something to control costs. This is cutting red tape. And it turns out, if you look at the history, over the last 5 years, there has not been one matter that this board acted on that got reversed. Not one. And so we use that as a backdrop of, you got, and if they want to hear it, they can pull it. And we'll go to that now. So what else is new? After any matter is approved, by the Housing Commission Board, the Housing Authority will receive another 7-day notice. This is very similar to what we did in that disposition policy and acquisition policy that we've already had. We'll receive a notice of the approval, and any two members of the Housing Authority may elect to have a matter heard. If we go back to the acquisition policy, you may recall when we were acquiring, Debbie was out buying real estate, we acquired one in Councilmember DeMaio's district, and we brought it forward. He asked that the matter be pulled. In that case, there only needed one person to pull a matter. As a result of that, Rick and Debbie went over and talked to him convinced him that there was nothing wrong. And there was a good deal, and he pulled his request back. And so from the time that disposition and acquisition policy has gone forward, the council and the Housing Authority has never asked that a matter be reversed that you approve. As a practice here, the Communications and Government Relations Department will make sure that these notices are delivered on the date of your approvals. They'll have 7 days to act, ask that these matters be pulled. That request will go to Communications and Government Relations. And if two members don't ask that it be pulled, your action will become final 7 days after you make it. This is a big deal. It will, particularly in acquisition of real estate, where we now don't have to wait another 4 weeks to get up there to get something done. We need to be nimble. Matter of fact, one of the original statements in 79 made by a chair of the Housing Commission at that time, a guy by the name of Solomon, interestingly enough, was that he indicated in minutes that I found as I was getting ready to try a lawsuit on behalf of the commission. I was looking back for history. The minutes said that the Housing Commission was formed to be nimble and to be able to act quickly because of real estate transactions. And so originally the thought was, we'll create this body that can work very quickly and go out and acquire properties. So in any event, I think we've turned that corner and we're back there again. The new process will save time and expedite the provision of affordable housing. Attached to your workshop report is attachment one, which is a sort of a strikeout of all the changes. I'm just highlighting the big ones. There are definitional changes that were made that are of no consequence, but the highlight ones that I'm going through. And again, this will be effective on December 15th, and we'll be using it on January the 13th. The Housing Authority voted 8-0. On the 15th to also approve revisions to our disposition and our acquisition policies. So what we did is brought those policies in conformance with the new ordinance. The old one said that one person could pull it, so we had to fix that. We also put some additional language in there that will deal with something that's been an issue from day one, and that is to allow the commission to convey assets that it has or dispose of assets it hasn't disposed as broad. Ground lease, transfer, grant deed, assignment, you name it, it's a disposition. It will have the ability under that program to convey units or projects to Housing Development Partners, for instance, or an LLC that's a sole member of which is the Housing Commission, for the purposes of allowing that entity to do tax credit financing to be able to rehab properties that the Housing Commission needs and which rehab is required by the critical needs assessment, the green assessment that's already been done. And that work is underway. So in some instances, it'll be to the benefit of the Housing Commission to ground lease the property to HDP, let HDP set up an entity similar to what they did on the Churchill or on San Diego Square and go forward and get various financing that will help get this underway. In addition, the new policy says that we can't do this unless there are adequate safeguards built in to make sure the commission can, upon a default by HDP, immediately get the property back. One, and I don't suspect that'll happen, but we need to prepare for it. And two, allow the commission to automatically get it back at some term with either an option or the termination of the lease or whatever. But and as part of this situation, any transfer will be subject to getting an appraisal within 6 months of the date of the transaction that will indicate that the commission is getting fair market value for whatever is being done. So, in short, that we think that's a very good thing. In addition, as to single family homes and condominium units, they may be either sold or acquired by the president and CEO by notice to both the Housing Commission Board and the Housing Authority Board. You may recall we have the Neighborhood Stabilization Act that came in where there was a $9 million that was dumped on our doorstep, and we were told to spend it. And during the time, as you'll recall, that the economy was not doing exactly well, and there were some bargains out there. And there were a number of private investors who were out picking up these single-family units. So one of the things we did with that policy at that time is said, let the commission go out. We'll get them. We'll buy them. And then we'll resell them to individuals. So what we did is we amended this policy to allow us to do that for any property. So if we get back to a situation where it makes sense to buy a single-family unit or a condominium for the purposes of selling it to a low- or moderate-income person, we can do that. By the way, one of the goals that Mr. Gentry has is to work on workforce housing. We built in a provision on the acquisition and the disposition policies allowing for the production of units and projects up to 120% of AMI. It may be that we'll be able to get former redevelopment money from the successor agency that will come over, and those still have old redevelopment agency strings on it, which allows us to go up to 120% for those. So it's something we're looking at as a way to maybe utilize this process. The commission board, with respect to this, so if the CEO decides there's a good opportunity and we want to buy some single family residences, you'll get notice of it. And if you decide we want to hear that, it'll come to you for a hearing as well. Same thing to the housing authority. All other acquisitions or sales come to this board, and you will have the decision. We'll give the notice to the housing authority, and if at the end of 7 days it's not pulled, and if history is any indicator, it won't be, we're done. And we don't have to go any further with that process at all. We've revised only two of 52 policies. We're going to be moving through the other ones. Debbie's team and Deborah Fischel Falk's group has put a lot of work into doing that. We found as we took these first two forward, city attorney has some different ideas about formatting and things, and it took a little time to get those two ready to go. They're the two most important, so we got those through. So we got a little work to do on these 50. We now know what they want, so we're going to do that. Housing Commission is required in one of the policies, I think it's the disposition policy, to quarterly explain any properties that we've gotten rid of, disposed of, and twice a year any acquisitions, and of course we'll do that. Once the policies are amended, they're going to go on our website so that anybody can see them. Right now, our policies are on the intranet. Anybody within the Housing Commission can see it, but anybody outside cannot. This is a request by Council President Leitner when the matter went forward. So that, I can go into detail that will put you to sleep if I haven't already, but I can answer any questions. And Debbie's here, too, who's been, we've been doing this together for the whole time. And I tell you what, I'm excited. It is on an invitation for bid, where we used to have to bring it here and then take it up, and it's delayed by 4 weeks or 6 weeks in order to get a hearing. Now you approve it. We give them a notice, and we're done. Marcel was talking to Marcel Gresham after the meeting yesterday, and he said he couldn't believe that we were at this point. And knowing the way we've had to do it in the past and the delays that went on, and delays cost money, and extra money drive up the price of housing, that's not a good thing. So anyway, in short, I'm very pleased with where we are. I hope you are as well.
Commissioner Tassa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Almost sounds too good to be true. I mean, this is great, and as you said, Mr. Christensen, this is really a testament to what the staff and the board have been performing here with this organization. This is a vote of confidence from the City of San Diego, and this is wonderful. My only question really is it real clear in your mind as to what classifies as a major policy and what doesn't? I mean, we don't want to leave any room for error. We don't want to abuse this, but we, you know, I want to understand what the parameters are here.
There have been some policies that personnel is one that's been delegated by the Housing Authority already to the Housing Commission. So that would be one that I would take as not being a major policy. Truthfully, about any other of the policies that we have, and there are 52 of them, most of those will require, if you want to change them, it's going to require that we go both places.
Mr. Gentry?
I'll give you an example of what I think would be a major policy revision that I would want full vetting with both sources of governance, and that is a workforce housing program, which I've charged Chuck and Debbie with coming up with the details of during this fiscal year. And so I think what would be a major policy change is a new program, or a significant change to an old program. And I think that it's I've got a pretty good sense of what that would involve, and I've got a counsel who will counteract me if he has a different opinion. And I think that that's that helps. I think that I'd like to point out to the board that I initiated conversations along this line with the city council about 5 years ago, and the response was, we need to be able to trust you, and we think we can, but we need more time. And now we've had that time. We've had 8 full years with the new regime, 8 full years, 7 full years with the new board chairmanship. We have proven ourselves, and it reflects, I think, the two things that I think you have to do to be perceived as a good agency. Number one is to be good, and number two, communicate it enough so that people know that you are. And I think our communications efforts, both the formal part that Marie and her people do so well, but also the informal peer-to-peer practitioner relationships that we have heavily with Debbie, with Chuck, with other staff members here that interrelate with the city literally every day. And that didn't used to happen. Our relationships used to be fairly reactive and reluctant. And now we're very assertive and aggressive about making sure we share information. So I think that what the council did, and Sherman was the last one to come to it, and some of the extra provisions he put in, I think were very healthy to make sure that no matter who the CEO is or who the relevant senior staff are, that we have to communicate with them, but we don't necessarily have to get them to dot the I's and cross the T's. And I think that's kind of where I would put the differentiation here. We're still going to share, and certainly not going to try to surprise anybody with anything. But when it comes time to get something done, this reduces bureaucracy.
No question about it. I just want to make sure that our understanding of what falls under these amendments and the city's understanding are aligned.
And in that regard, it would be my advice that if there's any question, we take it there. And in addition, we will, if there is any question, the city attorney is not shy about getting involved in what we're doing. So we'll do that too. We'll vet it there. And as Rick said, we can get in to see every council member too. So to the extent something's coming forward and there's even a gray area, we'll ask. But again, my advice would be if there's a question, we'll take it forward.
And Mr. Tassin, if there is a problem in the future in that regard, I know exactly where it's going to land. And I'll try to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'll affect the whole organization. I just want to make sure that this works flawlessly. It could be a political angle that causes somebody to complain that we've overstepped our boundaries. And that's why I'm asking, is there a prescriptive list? Or, I mean, do we have a common understanding, et cetera?
No, it's a great question, and there is no list, but in law, there's some gray areas, but we'll deal with this in a prudent way so that, and by the way, the next goal is they want to see what happens after a year, the council does, and if it goes well, it would be nice to remove some of those other items from what has to go up for hearings as well. And I think that's the goal. So, to your point, we don't want to have a mistake. We want this to go smoothly.
I'll also address one other issue, and that is the misunderstanding can go two ways. And that's one reason why now there it requires two council members to formally pull an item rather than just one. And that's to keep a potential rogue in the future. Don't think there are any of them down there now, but that's not always been the case, from basically trying to inject politics into a transaction. So if it takes two, then that's more than just one with their own parochial interests. And Chuck, also, don't we have a few housekeeping issues related to this that we'll need to bring to this board for the January board meeting?
Yeah, we do. One that we want to bring is from time to time, a matter particularly concerning real estate will come up after 7 days before a meeting, and so we'll have a special meeting. And so on those, we don't want to have to go to the two hearings. So one of the cleanups that we want to do is bring forward a resolution in January to this board saying if there's a legitimate Brown Act special meeting that can be noticed 24 hours in advance of the hearing, we want the ability – we want the council to approve the ability and the housing authority to approve the ability for us just to give them notice 24 hours in advance of the hearing rather than on the 7 days before. Because effectively, and I've seen it many times, and you have too, where we'll have a supplemental agenda that's come out afterwards just because everything wasn't ready to go when we went 7 days in advance. So that's one issue. We're going to want to clean up the procurement code as well, to deal with levels of authority, delegations of authority that's being worked on now. And so very quickly, that will be before you as well. Hope is in January.
I think the council's compliance and approval, compliance with you know, what we're proposing and approval of what we're proposing is both a recognition and the imposition of a responsibility. The recognition is that this organization, now, you know, all the way through, but this organization at the top, meaning our senior management and our board, have been conducting themselves in a very highly professional manner, that they recognize the responsibilities that have been imposed on both. And that we are transparent in terms of communicating and making sure that everybody knows what we're trying to do. We're not afraid to tell people what we want to do, and we're not trying to hide anything. The imposition of the responsibility is that Mr. Gentry and senior staff have to continue with that high degree of professionalism and openness. But this board, as it progresses, because we've had changes in the last 8 years. There, you know, there's not many here that were here 8 years ago. But this board, as it moves forward and as it continues to evolve and change, has to maintain the highest level of professional responsibility to the organization in reviewing the matters that come forward and in asking questions, both before it gets to the board and at the board meeting, and to take very seriously its watchdog responsibility and its leadership responsibility on it. So that's the imposition of the responsibility, is this board has to continue being as good as it is. Thank you. You've completed it? Okay. And now we'll go to item 106.
Good morning again, Debbie Ruane. I'm going to turn this over to Jennifer McKinney and Candy. They're going to give you a presentation on the Real Estate Operations Department. We're very happy to present this information to you. It's informational and a great story that highlights Jennifer's leadership and the evolution and accomplishments made by this team.
Thank you, Debbie. Good morning, Chair Gramling, Commissioners, Mr. Gentry, and Mr. Christensen. My name is Jennifer McKinney. I'm the Vice President of Real Estate Operations in the Real Estate Division. With me today is Candy Roberts. She's a Housing Programs Manager within the Property Management Group. The Housing Commission Real Estate Operations Department is composed of two distinct teams, Portfolio Management and Property Management. As you can see from the chart, this is a large group consisting of 60 employees, all with diverse skill sets. Some of the roles within the group include maintenance technicians, asset managers, property managers, and housing construction supervisors. Portfolio management is responsible for the strategic, long-term, and sustainable operation plans for the Housing Commission's real estate portfolio. This includes the oversight and monitoring of the asset's physical and financial health, as well as ensuring program compliance. Property management is responsible for the day-to-day operations, including leasing and maintenance, in the administration of affordable programs for the 2,300-plus units of rental housing within the portfolio. Without further ado, I'll turn this over to Candy so that she can share with you some of the highlights from the past year, as well as what's on the horizon for the Property Management Department.
Good morning. As Jennifer said, my name is Candy Roberts, and I'm here today to share with you the exciting work that we do here at the Housing Commission. Excuse my voice. I'm sorry about that. The Property Management Department is comprised of 48 staff members. 44 of those staff members work out in the field. We consider these frontline employees ambassadors of the agency. There are 17 teams, each team comprised of a maintenance technician, paired with a property manager. This means each team has an average caseload size of about 135 units. The property management group administers various programs such as public housing, tenant and project-based voucher programs, and tax credit projects. Rent limits for most of the programs are within the 80% affordability tier of the area median income level, which for a family of four equates to about $73,000. The portfolio is comprised of 155 properties, 2,307 units, and 340 buildings. As you can see, the housing stock is varied from single-family homes to five-bedroom units. The agency also owns one SRO, the Hotel Sanford, and administers the public housing program for 154 units. Oh, I think that was I'm sorry about that. Just back a little bit. Okay, there we go. Sorry. Our portfolio spans from as far north as Del Mar, as far south as San Ysidro, and as far east as the border to La Mesa. The properties cover a 300-square-mile territory, and as a scattered site portfolio, presents a challenge from an operational standpoint. There are currently 12 satellite offices, with three of those offices being established as main hubs, serving the north, central, and southern areas within the city. This interactive Google map, Earth map, reflects all of the San Diego Housing Commission-owned properties and can be found on the agency's website. Now on to that slide, sorry. I want to share with you some of the statistics and accomplishments for this department during the last fiscal year. There were 345 move-ins and 360 move-outs. The average occupancy for the fiscal year was 98%. As a comparison, the average occupancy for apartment homes in San Diego County is 96%. In addition to preparing 345 apartment homes for new move-ins, the maintenance technicians completed over 12,000 work orders last year. That is roughly 750 work orders per year per technician. The maintenance staff strives to complete most maintenance and repairs in-house, including painting, plumbing, and minor electrical work. Our group drove revenue to $27 million in FY16, and we came within 0.4% favorably of the proposed budget. That's impressive, considering there are 155 individual properties, each with their own respective budgets. We analyze each line item with every single property during the budget season and work hard to create a realistic budget that allows us to maintain the standard at our properties. Some of the team's additional accomplishments include the Housing for San Diego initiative. 25 San Diego Housing Commission-owned units were dedicated to this program, which rapidly rehouses homeless families and individuals. Since the program's inception, there have been 13 graduates from the program. This means that 13 households have been able to stabilize their housing situation and are now able to pay rent without that temporary subsidy. We work very closely with the Achievement Academy to provide valuable resources to the clients in the program. Also, we are leveraging technology to gain operational efficiencies. The mobile maintenance inspection modules were deployed in the past year, and this enables our maintenance staff to document inspections and generate and complete work orders when they are out in the field, producing real-time information with the use of the tablet. As I mentioned earlier, the staff tries to accomplish as much as they can in-house. They have managed smaller scale projects, such as landscaping upgrades and renovation work in the common areas, including the laundry facilities. Everyone is focused on adding value to the property and improving the residents' quality of life at our communities. I want to share with you some of the photos of our drought-tolerant landscaping upgrades at our Eastman, Pulitzer, and El Camino properties. These projects were important in achieving a sustainable water conservation plan. The next slide shows pictures of two laundry room upgrades at our Maya Linda and Pulitzer properties. Many elements within this project were largely completed by the maintenance staff in-house. This saves time and money and yields a great finished product. Looking ahead in FY17, we have set goals that align with the agency's strategic plan. One of the new projects is a collaboration with finance to develop an online resident portal, which enables residents to pay their rent online and complete work orders online. The team also dedicated a considerable amount of time in the past year developing a comprehensive policy and procedures manual. This playbook captures best practices for the property management industry, bearing in mind the agency's goals, missions, and resources. Another important goal is to reduce the number of days a unit sits vacant by 20% in 2 years. The baseline for this goal is around 50 days. The amount of time doesn't involve just the maintenance within the unit, but procuring the goods and services needed for the turnover work, the marketing of a unit, sourcing of applicants through various channels and waitlists, all which can be time-consuming and not necessarily under our purview. However, we are going to dissect the process and seek out opportunities to save time, money, and more importantly, house residents faster. In the first 6 months, the days vacant average has been reduced by 10% already. We look forward to reporting out on our progress and success to you in the future. This is not always an easy business, but each staff member here is mission-driven and takes pride in serving the people within San Diego County. Sorry.
Thank you, Candy. Today I'm pleased to share some of the highlights of the portfolio management team. As Candy mentioned, the San Diego Housing Commission's portfolio is diverse. In addition to the residential units, the portfolio management team administers 15 ground leases to various developers and service providers. The group also provides oversight of 8 commercial leases, including those here at Smart Corner, as well as Hotel Sanford and Courtyard. The portfolio management team tripled in size last year, growing to a team of 10. One reason for the growth was to implement the asset management protocols prescribed in the best practices playbook developed in collaboration with TCAM last year. But another reason was to allocate resources to address the physical needs of the portfolio. As a refresher, the Green Physical Needs Assessment completed last year provided an outline of the remaining lifespan along with a replacement schedule for each component within the units and the buildings. Further, the average age of the portfolio is now approximately 40 years old. We needed to take this information and form a plan. Hence, the asset preservation team was formed. This small but mighty group of 4 has been charged with addressing the critical needs of the portfolio until such time that a comprehensive renovation can take place. The team spent much of last year planning for this year. However, they also managed to complete many capital improvement projects. In fiscal year 16, this team completed projects at 28 properties. The projects improved 580 apartments in some form, which in turn impacted about 1,900 residents. The team's work included the most critical of building components, such as roof replacements, termite treatments, and water heater upgrades. In addition, lender reserves in the amount of $600,000 were drawn down to fund some of this work. And for maximum operational efficiencies, the team implemented Yardi mobile maintenance, mobile inspections, a web-based program that would document their inspections in the field on a tablet. For fiscal year 17, the team developed an annual budget of $16.4 million, comprised of moving to work and local funds, as well as redevelopment bond funds from the city. It is expected that by year-end, 87 properties will have been touched, which impacts about 3,300 residents. The improvements slated for and currently underway are more comprehensive in nature, but can still be done while the resident is either in place or relocated for only a short period of time. The pictures shown reflect completed projects. Examples of these projects include replacement of roofs, exterior painting, fencing, and kitchen and bathroom cabinetry and countertops. The team has spent a considerable amount of time researching and selecting the most durable, yet cost-effective, and/or efficient solutions related to material specifications. You may recall that we have grouped properties into buckets based on how they are financed and grouped by geography. That division served as a starting point to plan the work, enabling us to leverage the number of jobs within an area when soliciting bids from contractors. This has allowed us to not only secure best pricing, but also assist in the construction management provided by our staff. Again, there is a team of only three that is out in the field managing work at 87 properties throughout the city this year. By the end of this month, which also marks the halfway point of our fiscal year, it is expected that 71% of the total budget will be committed and under contract. The planning efforts are paying off. We couldn't accomplish this without the assistance of our supportive departments here at the agency. Specifically, the procurement team, who has helped provide us with resources we need, including job order contracts, which has saved to the tune of $400,000 due to cost and time savings. Also, finance, who has deployed a job cost module so the expenditures can be budgeted and tracked line by line on each individual property. Switching gears to the asset management team, you may recall that just over a year ago, the group put into practice a best-in-class asset management program, allowing them to keep their finger on the pulse of the physical, financial, and overall health of the assets. In the never-ending quest for funding, we are now tapping lender reserves for eligible capital improvements while continuing to build property reserve funds. We are also leaning into risk management so as to identify and address emerging issues before they become major problems. The risk rating system has parameters built around financial and physical operations, the market, property conditions, as well as program compliance. The group has started publishing quarterly reports related to the portfolio's performance. These newly developed reports are now created through the use of Tableau, the business intelligence software platform. Tableau is changing the way we run the business. The solution helps us to identify opportunity and anomalies by elevating issues in a visual format. This dashboard reflects the accounts payable activities by vendor and by property. The color green denotes optimal performance. And this dashboard depicts committed purchase orders, including actuals to budget. As you can see, it's rather easy to hone in on the properties that might need attention. From there, we can drill down to dig deeper. This tool allows us to manage the budgets proactively and not in a reactive state. There is more of the same planned for the next fiscal year and beyond. We intend to address the needs within the Fannie Mae North and Central portfolios, touching another 33 properties next year. The group is also planning a comprehensive rehabilitation of Via Las Cumbres, which is a second phase at the property in the Linda Vista community. The Hotel Sanford will receive significant plumbing upgrades next year. And lastly, the group is in the early stages of creating a multi-year strategic capital plan that will ensure the preservation of the Housing Commission's assets for many years to come. We are exploring various financing vehicles, including low-income housing tax credits, and also strategies to reposition assets within the portfolio. We look forward to keeping you apprised on our progress. This concludes our presentation, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
Commissioner Tassa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Informative. It's certainly learning for me to get these briefings. I'm interested in the trends. To show us what the move-ins and move-outs are is wonderful. I'm interested in knowing, is that growing or is that declining? And I ask that because I'm a landlord myself, and you know, what we're seeing is a lot less tenants moving around, given the fact that there's a shortage of inventory out there. And I'm wondering if you're seeing the same thing.
We are seeing the same thing. In fact, last fiscal year, our turnover rate was approximately 14%. In years prior, it ran around 17%. So that is an indicator that people are moving and staying put in place for years. And that's something that we're mindful of when thinking about the future, how to spur progression to the next step in the housing cycle. Candy can speak a little bit to market conditions here in San Diego.
We, here in our, with our stock, we have a considerable amount of stability. A lot of the deployments last year and a lot of people moving out of state attributed to the vacancy loss, the 96% throughout the county. Our rates, keeping our rates affordable, have allowed us to maintain that stability, and it hasn't grown, and we don't expect it to grow.
What about in terms of our outlay for maintenance? Is that staying the same, growing, declining?
It grows slightly year over year, and part of the reason is that is not just the cost of goods and services, but as I mentioned, our portfolio is aging. And we are starting to address the physical needs of the portfolio, and we're starting to plan for comprehensive renovations. But until we're able to touch the properties, the maintenance costs do creep up on us.
In fact, that physical needs assessment that staff has been doing has really given us quite a list of improvements that need to be made. And one of the tools, they just touched on it lightly, but, you know, our partners and other developers that come in have seen that with the property values having gone up over the years and everything, that they can recapitalize. Recapitalize is a nice word for we're going to refinance. And we can utilize the tax credit vehicle to refinance internally and generate the funds necessary to do a total responsible rehabilitation on those projects and properties that need to do that. So this board is going to see, I'm going to guess that in the next 12 months, this board is going to see a number of opportunities or requests coming in for that recapitalization. And get to take advantage of that.
Mr. Gramling, if I may,
yes.
I wanted to mention to the board that one of the changes we've made internally has been to align Jennifer McKinney directly with Mike Pavko. And this is critical because Mike oversees the development arm of HDP. And so as Jennifer and Mike are working on short-term fixes, they can also look at long-term fixes. So having the operations and property management, asset management, and development all within one bubble has been really a tremendous opportunity for us to make better long-term decisions.
And I know Mr. Gentry wants to say something, but I'll just make a quick comment. Candy, we don't bite. As I said earlier, congratulations. You did a good job on your first effort at that table. And I have no doubt that you'll begin to feel much more comfortable the next time even. Yes, Mr. Gentry?
Just two comments, Mr. Chair. Number one, and Debbie alluded to this as well, the 2,300 units that Jennifer and Candy talked about here do not include the approximately 1,000 units that are owned by HDP. So we really are a 3,300-unit organization. And as Debbie said, the alignment of development HDP with property and asset management means that in addition to growing our stock, we're going to be committed, first of all, to preserving our stock. And as Mr. Chairman, you indicated, the use of 4% tax credits going forward is going to be the major driving force behind that. And again, if you look at us compared to most of the public housing our cohorts out there in other cities, we're already where they need to be in the next 5 or 10 years if they survive. So this is huge. Second thing, I want to compliment Jennifer, Candy, and Debbie for doing an excellent job. As you all know, my long-term background is property and asset management as well, and I like to say development types come and go, and they'll build a property and walk away from it. Us poor people stuck with it long-term are the real heroes, though. And so if you make a property operate 20, 30 years, that's the key to our success. And I think we've got the foundation here for what's going to be a sound organization long after many of us are going to be gone from this business. So this is excellent work. I'm very pleased with the way we restructured this the last few years. Debbie, thank you.
Thank you again. We have no other items on the agenda, so I'll accept a motion to adjourn. And Commissioner Cerny has seconded that motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
This meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.